This is David Duke. This is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of importance to Europeans and people of European descent wherever they may dwell upon the earth. It's also important to all people because we all have similar questions and similar problems. The right of every people to determine its own destiny, to control its own affairs, to preserve its way of life, to feel at home among its own people, with its own culture, own values, own faith. These, I believe, are fundamental human rights, and these are rights that must be accorded to all people and should be accorded to all people. I think everyone has a right, every people has a right to strive for these basic human rights, and I include in that right, obviously, my own people, who I am very fond of and partial toward, and that is the European American people. We've got a great heritage. We've got a fantastic culture behind us. We have a beautiful countenance of our people and a great sense of art and literature and music and architecture. And look at our scientific achievements. We've literally put our footprints on another sphere, on the moon. And I believe that if our people are able to unlock the talents and abilities that lie within them, I believe we will be able to go across the universe, across the vastness of space. And that seems so far from today, in a sense. I mean, we're having certain space probes and space advances, but the truth is our own societies at our feet are collapsing, are disintegrating. And we're seeing this in almost every Western country. And that's really a theme that's existed all throughout history. Why is it the civilizations rise, sometimes almost out of nothing, flourish, become great, great architecture and art and systems of government, systems of law, education, systems of production and organization and business, systems of religion, spiritual values and so forth that go forth in their own societies. And then, not suddenly, but it seems suddenly in a historical context, they begin to disintegrate. They begin to slowly wither away. Why is that? I believe that there's a lot of reasons for the decline of civilization, that there's not simply just one ever present in any culture. But I do believe that every culture that has fallen on the planet has found its founding elements have become dispossessed, lost, died out, or whatever. We saw that certainly in the Roman civilization to a great extent. The patricians, about 2,000 major families in Rome created the Roman Republic and gave us the greatness of Rome. And with time, through wars where many of them died in a dysgenetic way, obviously, often wars caused the most courageous, the most intelligent, the leaders to die first. In fact, historically, usually the generals, the leaders, were at the front, in front of their troops, leading their troops. And I think that's exactly the way white activists must be today as well. We must be in the front. There's a lot of people who sit behind some screen somewhere in their underwear, you know, and they're going to tell us how to do the change. But those of us that go out and speak, confront the enemy in public, that really offer themselves as a target, in a sense, to our worst enemies, those are the ones who deserve our greatest support. And by the way, those people that are out there fighting are usually the ones that have the least invective toward others out there. And there is a role for every sort of aspect of this cause. I mean, we need intellectuals. We need warriors. We need attorneys. We need business people. We need financiers. We need all kinds of elements to support a successful movement. But I can tell you this, the only successful movement that will ever take place is going to be done by leaders who get out there and lead and put themselves forward and present themselves to speak and not simply just go before a computer screen somewhere. And that's why I like the activism of men like Don Black, because Don has gone, traveled around the country, and he's spoken many times. He's been at, you know, he's shown his leadership. He's been at many demonstrations, many rallies with me. James Kelso is another good example. Not only has he on the computer, yes, the computer is a great tool, but when it came time to go out and support Sheehan, you know, against some of these other anti-people, these this pro-Iraq war crowd, which are really, see the shoe's on the other foot. I mean, I really used to believe, like in the Vietnam War, that, you know, that the peaceniks or the people against that war were kind of unpatriotic. But one thing I've learned today is that this war, it's unpatriotic to be for this war, because this war is not a patriotic war. It's not a war for America. And I hope that all my conservative friends, and I've had many of them, of course, who voted for me for the United States Senate and for governor and supported me in the House of Representatives here in Louisiana, you know, I just hope that they begin to get that through their mind, no matter what the media tells them. And by the way, it's the same media. By the same media that cheerleaded this war, it's the same media that threw garbage upon our troops as they came back from Vietnam. This is a Jewish war. This is a war for Israel. This is not a war for America. Never was. Never was. And those young men, and even women today, who've been killed, and almost 2,000 now, and 20 to 30,000 who have been wounded, maimed, crippled, disfigured, blinded. Those tens of thousands are just literally paying a price. A price, and this is the greatest betrayal, I think, in the history of this country. Not for this country. Not for this the society we live in, the well-being of our mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers and sons and daughters back home. But really for really a foreign land, a land that has no interest whatsoever in the character or the preservation of the American people. In fact, the same Jewish supremacists who support this war and support Israel wholeheartedly are the same people working very hard to break down our immigration laws in the United States and not to enforce our current immigration laws. Now, they run things. Now, I can show this. Kevin McDonald's done a great deal of research on this over the years. He's got a great he really points it out quite well in the Culture Critique, and I think I pointed out extremely well in Jewish Supremacism and My Awakening. The whole effort to change America from a European-based society, a white-based society, to a non-white majority, and eventually a third world kind of society, has been led lock, stock, and barrel by the Jewish supremacists, by the same people who supported the foundation and the creation of the State of Israel, which is a nation based on the preservation of the Jewish people, a nation with strict immigration policies, a nation with laws against intermarriage of Jews and non-Jews. They don't even legally recognize it. A nation with strict segregation between Jews and non-Jews. And that's the irony, but it's also, you know, the fact. And these are facts we've got to deal with. I read a very excellent article the other day in the New York Times talking about the cost of this war and the $245 or $250 billion, which has already been spent in this war, are nothing compared to the long-term costs. For instance, the author of one of the articles went back to the number of men that served in the in Desert Storm, or the original war, and the first Gulf War. And of course that war literally lasted only a couple weeks. This war has had a tremendous toll, and the cost per soldier that served in that conflict over the years has been calculated. And if you just take the same cost as what was in per soldier, the people serving in the time served in that conflict, and what's going on right now in Iraq, She extrapolates the cost for veteran benefits, hospital needs, medical needs, other aspects, long-term costs for the war, military equipment replaced, this kind of thing. And she shows that this war is going to cost in just a few years upwards of $1.3 trillion. $1.3 trillion, ladies and gentlemen, an ungodly sum of money. About a third of the entire budget of the United States of America, all aspects. I mean, it's an incredible amount of money, incredible waste, incredible damage to the United States of America. I read an interesting article recently on, and usually I get referenced to this by many of our readers and listeners. And by the way, if you want to pose a question to me or make a comment, you can go to stormfront.org, the town hall section. And this program is companioned with Stormfront. And whether you came here through davidduke.com or whether through whitesilverrights.com or through Stormfront, this is companioned, and we have an active forum, the town hall forum that appears on Stormfront, which allows you to go in there and to text commentary on this program. Text me questions, ideas, posts, which not only I will read, but many of our listeners will be able to read around the world. And we have many, many listeners around the world. And, of course, I share many posts and emails with you from people all over the world who are hearing this program. So that's an opportunity for you. You can also send me an email directly. And we change these periodically, so be prepared when that does change. But right now, the email address is info44@davidduke.com. That's info44@davidduke.com. And I'm looking forward to receiving your questions, your thoughts, your comments. I got an email from an individual who was talking about or writing about the Horowitz site. And you've heard of Horowitz before. He does the front page site. Horowitz, by the way, is a former Black Panther. Now he's supposedly a conservative. That's a true neocon. And if you notice, most of these so-called neocons were former Marxists, extreme leftists at one way or another. They just realized they couldn't sell that garbage for their Jewish supremacist agenda, so they became, quote, conservatives. And by the way, these same people that always talk about the fact that I was in the KKK many, many years ago, I mean, that's part of my name now. It's kind of funny, you know. Now they're going to have to change my name a little bit. It's going to be like, you know, former KKK man, Dr. David Duke, or Dr. former KKK, you know, man. Who knows what they're going to do? Or probably leave out the doctor altogether, because they certainly don't like to have any title of authority or teaching. And that's what a doctor truly is a teacher in terms of the way the term is defined. Well, I'm gonna excuse me. That's a big sneeze coming on. I was up actually almost all night last night preparing for the next Duke report and doing all the things that we had to do to get that finished and ready for press this morning. Actually, is the letter and so forth that accompanies the Duke report, and it was a big job. And I'm a little sleepy and obviously a little sneezy right now, so excuse the sneeze there. Anyway, Mr. Horowitz, you know, who is an extreme Jewish supremacist and former Black Panther, he's never identified in the press as former Black Panther, you know, Mr. Horowitz. But they always are very quick to identify me as former Klansman, former Ku Klux Klan leader, whatever they want to say, David Duke. And by the way, as people know, and I think they must know by now, I've never been charged with any sort of violent crime against any minority, or I've never encouraged such, and no member of my organization, when I was active, no member of my organization was ever charged with any sort of attack against any minority or any sort of violent action of any sort whatsoever, you know. And so what they basically accuse me of is, they accuse me of thought crimes. That's what I'm guilty of, having the wrong opinions. And it's kind of interesting how that they today judge people. You know, that if you have the wrong opinions in life at any time, even if it's 30, 40 years ago, according to them, if you had the wrong opinions, then boy, that's it. you are marked for life. Nothing you can do can ever make up for that in their minds. Anyway, Horowitz, through another article, it's another Jewish writer, talks about another individual, a Jewish individual by the name of Finkelstein. Now, Finkelstein, as you probably know, Norman Finkelstein, is the author of The Holocaust Industry, an excellent book showing how the Holocaust has become, or the propagation of the Holocaust has become, an incredible financial racket for certain segments of the Jewish community. And, of course, he's gotten a lot of the vitriol and the hatred of a lot of these Jewish supremacists who dominate the media. And this article was really against him. They talked about him and his attacks. And let me share some of from the data for this. There are, as it turns out, exceptions. This is a quote from the front page website. The largest academic publisher in the West Coast, the University of California Press, has not only signed off on the publication of Finkelstein's latest effort, Beyond Chutzpah, on the misuse of anti-Semitism and the abuse of history, but it has been unstinting in its defense of the book, hailing the virulent broadside against defenders of Israel and Jews generally, and the liberal law professor Alan Dershowitz specifically, as a model of scholarly achievement. The book, released in August, is typical of Finkelstein's oeuvre, bristling with invocations of the supposedly nefarious influence of Jewish elites. The book contains passages like the following. Now, let me quote this. This is a passage they quote of Finkelstein from his book, but it's a very good passage. He says, quote, Jewish elites in the United States have enjoyed enormous prosperity. From this combination of economic and political power has sprung, unsurprisingly, a mindset of Jewish superiority, wrapping themselves in the mantle of the Holocaust. These Jewish elites pretend, and in their own solipsistic universe, perhaps imagine themselves to be victims, dismissing any and all criticism as manifestations of, quote, anti-Semitism. And from this lethal brew of formidable power, chauvinistic arrogance, feigned or imagined victimhood, and Holocaust immunity to criticism has sprung a terrifying recklessness and ruthlessness on the part of American Jewish elites alongside Israel. They are the main fomenters of anti-Semitism in the world today. Coddling them is not the answer. They need to be stopped. He goes on. Finkelstein also revisits some of the themes of the Holocaust industry, claiming that, quote, like the Holocaust, anti-Semitism is an ideological weapon to deflect justified criticism of Israel and concomitantly powerful Jewish interests. In its current usage, anti-Semitism, alongside the, quote, war against terrorism, serves as a cloak for a massive assault on international law and human rights. And he goes on. He says, Dershowitz is impatient with that line of defense. One of the most offensive things they are saying in their defense is that they have the support of Jews. Our staff is Jewish. The people who endorse the book are Jewish. Some of our best friends are Jewish. Well, Norman Finkelstein proves that a Jew can be an anti-Semite. He says, in the end, Dershowitz has little doubt about why the press published Beyond Chutzpah. Quote, I think they have a double standard for judging the hard anti-Zionist right than they would for David Duke and the far right. But David Duke and Norman Finkelstein are the same, he says, except the Duke is slightly brighter. Well, thanks, but no thanks. I guess that's a way to criticize Finkelstein, by saying that I'm brighter. I think Mr. Finkelstein's quite a brilliant man, and he's written a lot of very interesting and revealing aspects of the Holocaust and of the intellectual dishonesty of Mr. Dershowitz. And I think it's fantastic, the work that he's doing, and I hope that he has a lot of success and a lot of future success over the next few years. By the way, they call him an anti-Semite. I guess anybody can become that these days. I mean, Finkelstein's, both of his parents survived the terrible conditions of the Second World War. Both of them were incarcerated. Both of them were prisoners of the National Socialists, but both of them lived throughout the entire war, were liberated, and survived this conflict. And that's pretty interesting in itself. And, you know, how can, you know, it's like calling somebody like this an anti-Semite's pretty doggone interesting. Because, I mean, I think that's a totally unjustifiable term. But, again, it's one of those terms that they use so frequently because, you know, there's just, you know, how do you fight it? How do you refute it? How do you deal with it? You throw this kind of thing out, you know, then people just have to deal with it directly. Anyway, this Ryan back, he says, he talked about the looter pictures, and we're getting a lot of email and a lot of discussions of the looter pictures. By the way, you can go to info44@davidduke.com to send me a direct email, or you can also go to stormfront.org in the town hall section. So, anyway, he says, if you want to see some more pictures of Martin Luther King Jr., some call him Looter Guide, then go to the thread, post photos of looters here, as many as you got. Okay, so you can find that on stormfront.org. Karsten says, greetings, Dr. Duke. I have a brief question regarding the news media and Jewish neoconservatives in the Bush administration. Most of the major news media opposed George W. Bush during his first bid for the presidency and his reelection campaign. Certainly no one can argue the media managers don't exactly relish the idea of Bush in the White House. To put it mildly, its coverage to the Iraq war with some 50 articles in Abu Ghraib and the New York Times front pages alone, and later retracted Time magazine article on Quran flush indicates such bias. My question is, how is it then that there seems to be this vast gulf between the Jewish-controlled media on the one hand and the Bush administration when it's clear Jewish neoconservatives such as Wolfowitz and Pearl were prominent in pushing for the war in Iraq? As Jewish intellectuals abandon the left for neoconservatism, are liberal Jews like the Schultzbergers who own the New York Times simply resisting the drift? Well, first off, let's be real straight about everything. The New York Times is one of the major publications supporting the Iraq war. And in fact, they have many columnists right now, and one of their main columnists, like Friedman's a perfect example, who are big supporters of the war. And yeah, they might editorialize about certain abuses that take place. They might editorialize about certain things. But you see, that's how they operate. And I tell you something. Yes, it's true that there are some media that made fun of them. They really kind of couldn't stand Bush because their natural position, their natural kind of affinity is toward the more liberal point of view. And they tend to support Democrats over Republicans and so forth. But at the same time, have you seen the Time magazine and Newsweek articles that have made Bush into be almost like a giant of courage and honor, you know, standing strong before the fires of 9/11, standing strong before the evils of Saddam Hussein, standing strong, you know, to convince the Allies. I mean, you know, don't think that one or two articles is necessarily means the press is off of George Bush. You know, yes, there is some dissent against George Bush, but it's really more of a minor dissent than a very powerful dissent. Secondly, let me explain something to you that they have to keep all of these presidents somewhat on the string. They can't let them become too popular. And why is that? The answer to that is really makes sense in terms of their own objectives. If the President of the United States, when George Bush was very popular after 9/11, he started making some noises about giving some justice to the Palestinians and removing the Jewish settlements in the West Bank, and he was trying to pressure Sharon to put a hold on the settlements and so forth. Of course, he quickly relented when Sharon told him that he wasn't going to do that. But, in fact, he was like a little puppy dog saying whatever they wanted. In fact, he was really insulted by Sharon, but he didn't care. He just continued to lick the boots of these evil men that kick him and beat him. But, you have to realize George Bush, for instance, in the reelection campaign, yes, of course. You know, many of them supported the Iraq war. Some of them, most of them did, in fact. And he himself was under some degree of attack, but he was more under, I think, a great degree of support. But he knew, because of the fact that there was some degree of dissent on these questions, he knew that if he didn't do what they wanted, if, in fact, he decided to expose this war as a Jewish war or or backtrack and say, let's get out of this damn thing. This is not doing any good for the United States of America. I don't want any part of this war. At that point, the last, I guess, phalanx of Jewish support, of Jewish radical support, would fall away, and he would be totally left out in the wind and rain to harvest the storm of abuse that they would heap upon him. And I can guarantee that storm of abuse would have been far worse than any Katrina. So I mean, you have to. It's very important for them to get a man to do what they say. If a president is too popular and too supported, then the president feels he can get away with doing what he thinks might be right in an instance. When he knows that he's hanging on by a thread, then he's in a situation where he realizes if the Jewish bloc go totally against him, as well as the other elements they've already got against him in society, when he realizes that hard, cold fact, then he's much more putty in their hands to use. From White Mike, hi, Dr. Duke. Here we go again with personal attacks. English, Italian, Pride, former member. This is location, United States, where the time of free speech is running out, multicultural trash is running in. Reason, David Duke, revolutionary or fraud? I told him to come here during town hall and ask him yourself. I mean, you know, again, it is always an open forum, but when you're dealing with that all the time, and I tell you, if you completely opened everything up to some sort of attacks or defensive attacks, we would get nothing done in terms of the Jewish supremacist problem. Do you realize that? I mean, a few Jewish activists, and by the way, they could pay a few people pennies to do this. They could literally take whatever forms we have in the movement and just turn them into slug fests and mud fests against all the people who are doing something positive. And by the end of it, there would be very precious little activity in the Jews. There'd be so much garbage thrown back and forth that people get disgusted by it. I got a letter the other day, which was very, very interesting. Very, very interesting. And he said, this is a story. I was a supporter for years of a number of different groups, and each of the groups had these splits and problems in it, and the infighting so disgusted me, I'm not going to get involved in any other groups again. I'm never going to get involved in any white activism again. And that's the kind of thing that we'd say it. English Italian Pride says, they said you pled guilty because you're facing a black jury. However, we both know that both sides may dismiss jury members without naming a reason. I feel you're abusing your power as a European rights leader. This is not meant to verbally attack you, provoke reactions. I'd simply like you to hear what I think, and I want you to hear your side of it. Well, I appreciate the question, and I tell you there's a very good answer for your question. All right? They said you pled guilty because you're facing a black jury. However, we both know that both sides may dismiss jury members without naming a reason. All right. Well, sir, I hate to inform you this, but what you think about the ability to dismiss a juror for no reason does not apply in the case of an individual such as myself. There is a federal rule in federal court called the Batson Amendment, or the Batson Ruling, which was ruled upon by the federal courts and backed up, in fact, by the Supreme Court. Now, normally, you can dismiss a certain... By the way, this is a new question in a real sense. If you have a jury pool that is very strongly a minority, or very small white, or whatever. It's, you know, the fact that you could each dismiss a certain number of jurors will not prevent that jury from being dominated by non-white people. In fact, you're up there dismissing the black jurors, and the prosecution is dismissing the white jurors, and so what do you have out of that? And then you have whatever the population of the area entails. And as you know, many times white people are very much intimidated. I mean, the way it is, even if you had an all-white jury, the intimidation on the jurors about doing the right thing and going against racism and going against, these evil people is intense and powerful. They all know that if they go on the side of the government, they all know that when the whole trial is over, they can do the book contracts and they can get the interviews and they can be popular in the media. But if they end up say, setting free someone who the media doesn't like, then they end up to be idiotic jurors and the Golden Gate's not open for them. But specifically dealing with your question, the Batson Amendment prevents all that. Now, the Batson Amendment came about because blacks were complaining that they were discriminated against in the setting of jury pools. And primarily they were saying this happened by certain prosecutors. And that is absolutely correct to a degree. Prosecutors knew that black jurors tended to exonerate black defendants. And so what happened was the courts ruled that, and by the way, if black jurors tend to exonerate black defendants, what do you think black jurors would tend to do with a former Ku Klux Klan defendant or a white defendant? Do you think they would tend to exonerate them, or do you think they would tend to convict them no matter what the information, no matter what the evidence? But the courts then ruled on this basis, and they said no, that a black person, and this is the exact ruling of the court, a black person's right to sit on a jury, you know, supersedes the right of the defendant to get necessarily a fair trial. That's right. I mean, that's the way it is now. So the truth is that today, if you dismiss a white juror, you have no problem. You have a certain number of what they call dismissals, where there's no argument. You like a certain number of automatic dismissals. But if you try to do that with a black person, you can't. You have to show cause, just like you would with another juror, with any other juror that's not part of your that's your right to dismiss. So the Batson rule changes all that. My attorney, in fact, was involved in a case specifically that was dealing with the Batson rule. He was defending an individual in Tampa, Florida, who had a Confederate flag on his property. The blacks next door had a big problem with him. The blacks were disruptive, and he had a problem with the jury, and my attorney couldn't even dismiss, couldn't use his, quote, peremptory challenges, that's what it's called, to dismiss jury members. For blacks, you have to show cause just like any other person. And by the way, it is not a show of cause to say that a person is black, therefore he cannot render a fair jury for a Ku Klux Klansman or a white, quote, white racist or a white person. All right? That's not, the courts will not recognize that. And so that's something you can go into a million kind of attacks, because you see, any kind of argument, any kind of person, any kind of individual can be accused of certain things, and you can say he did this or he did that, and you can get into this big long discussion. Like, we've discussed this now 10 minutes, we should be talking about the Jewish questions, but I did take this question because this is a perfect example of how they go. There are often very good reasons for things. There's very good answers for things. But if you deal with this kind of thing all day long, you could just basically not work on the cause. You could never really make any sort of forward progress on our cause. All right, Roger Brown writes. He says, I found the following article in Old National Vanguard catalog, typed it up for a fellow patriot. I thought you'd also share it here. I hope you enjoy it and find it useful. Well, it's a long article, and we have it on stormfront.org, and certainly people are welcome to take a look at that and to go over it. And by the way, in a way, once in a while, I guess it's good to handle a question like that to show you the nature of enemies. I've heard that an index version of Jewish supremacism will become available soon. Can you tell me when? I think it will increase its effectiveness as a tool for educating the neophytes. Congratulations on your recent achievements. By the way, what was your doctoral thesis? My thesis was, Zionism as a form of Jewish ethnic supremacism. And but anyway, thank you so much about that. I appreciate your confidence, and I think that my doctoral achievement will help, I think, make some of my words more powerful to some of those people out there who need that kind of prop. I don't need that kind of prop. You know, I don't care whether somebody's a doctor or a master or a bachelor or a high school dropout or a grade school dropout. What I care is their ability to reason their ideas. But people do care a lot about titles in our society. I guess they always have. And if that title and that educational achievement helps people, take a second look at some of the things that I do, and and helps maybe prevent some of the book banning, because it makes it a lot harder. You know, when I go into a country and they might try to ban me or ban my books because of their nature, it's kind of harder to do that to a college professor, to a PhD. And it makes it look more obvious as a form of intellectual suppression and suppression of freedom of speech and really of human rights. Because these are the basic rights that we're talking about as a human being that are being abrogated when their free speech is being abrogated by the powers that be. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've had a really good show today. I've enjoyed the opportunity to be with you here, and I do want to take one more quick look if I can get past to the emails again. Make sure there's no other. I have a few also the last few days, and I probably should catch those. Because if you do go to davidduke.com, you can do a lot of things. I mean, you can find a lot of material that's recent and material that's older. This is from Jose Maria Carretero, and he says, "There's a member of Stormfront that's libeling you. I'm ashamed that the moderators of Stormfront allow this. I admire your work. You have awakened most whites who don't see the truth, the dangers for our race and heritage. Thanks for all." Well, thank you very much, Jose Maria, and this is directly from Spain, and he's aware of some of the good work I think I've done in Spain, helping to wake up and inspire the patriots there, and I'm very, very happy that we were able to do that, and I'm happy this individual is out there defending me a little bit. Another question, Dr. Duke, if you have the time, this is my second question. Don't want to take advantage. I heard Richard Nixon was worried about the Jewish control of the media. Why did he not do something about it? Please reply. Thank you. I think Richard Nixon was a completely political animal. And I think there's huge numbers of people in Capitol Hill and in the political process, high ups, who are absolutely aware of Jewish power, but they submit to it because they know that power butters their side of the bread. And that's just the way it is. And they reap tremendous benefits, fame, position, whatever. By the way, this is Sir Bradlove again. This was his first one. He said he had a second one. But the first question was, I just finished listening to the Sunday show and I'd like to inform you on a show I saw on Jack the Ripper. The show said that a Jew was going to testify against the guy that the police was sure was the Ripper. When this Jew found out that the accused was a Jew, he refused to testify. This is more proof of what you are exposing. The show was on the History Channel, so it does have a little legitimacy. Please comment. Well, of course, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, this is the kind of thing that goes on and has gone on historically. Jewish law, basically, would make it, illegal and improper and immoral for a Jew to testify against another Jew, especially in a Gentile court. And so this is the kind of thing you have to think of the impact this has, for instance, on judges. If you have a Jew who's educated all of his life about the evils of the Holocaust and how Gentiles are, out to get Jews and kill Jews, and you're taught that the Jews have to stick together and they've got to be brothers, and the Jews are under siege in the Middle East, and there's terrorists going out to kill the Jews in the Middle East, and there's these vicious anti-Semites, and that Jew is sitting as a judge. And let's say you have a Jew, a devout Jew, and a Gentile comes up and it's some sort of a legal dispute over a company or over taxes or over whatever, over stock options or over some sort of a wrongful death suit or a legal suit or whatever. Don't you see the role this plays? So when you start to accumulate power the way they've accumulated, this ethnocentrism has a snowball effect. That's the best way to put it. And that's the best way to put it. I'm gonna go on now. I got a negative one, but I don't have time to handle that one. I'm gonna probably handle that next time. I'm looking forward to doing that. And that was some guy who was talking about race, and I'll give you the first idea of it so we can go to that maybe next time. Brother from the Planet or something like that's just the moniker. I'll be totally honest with you. I hate white supremacists, and I consider those who are white supremacists in their philosophy as harbingers of a deadly, poisonous teaching, which spew that black folks are genetically inferior and likewise more apt to commit more crime and what have you. You know, exactly. You know, so anyway, he's one of those many people, you know, obviously, who has real concern about white supremacy. And in fact, really what we believe is not white supremacy. Maybe he's right about blacks and race and crime. Maybe he could be. You know, statistics, however, show the black crime rate is very much, grossly, more than among white people. If you're among black people, you have a much greater chance of being killed, robbed, raped, or murdered. That's just a fact of the matter. If you have two rooms and one room is full of black kids and the other room is full of white kids, and you happen to know that your kid has maybe a 10 times greater chance of being robbed or raped or murdered or assaulted or killed in that room than the other room. In fact, if it were reversed, if the parent knew that in the white kid room, maybe they were all criminals and psychopaths, and you knew that the kid had a greater chance of being hurt in that room than in the room with the normal black kids, which room would you put your children into? You know, that's not about racism. It's about realities. And the truth is the black crime rate is much, much higher than the white crime rate. But again, this is one more person who talks about, he's so concerned about white supremacy. You know, I'm not a white supremacist. And if he believes what he believes about black crime and about black abilities and that we're all the same and this, you know, it's all environment, then in their own environment, then their own culture, their own country, then blacks can do pretty well. In fact, he should be pretty happy because he apparently doesn't like white racists. Most people believe that of this persuasion believe that our society is controlled by white racism. These are the same kind of people that say white racism gave a different relief to the victims of Hurricane Katrina than they did for white people. The truth is the white people were absolutely ignored in this conflict to a great extent, in this terrible catastrophe. The white St. Bernard was totally wiped out, and there was no help at all to them. Many times for more than 10 days, people died in their homes for people not coming, while the attention was in the black areas. And a lot of this reason for this late delay was the fact that many of the blacks in New Orleans were acting like absolute savages. That's the truth. Shooting at rescue forces and rescue boats. And, of course, this hurt the whole rescue effort for the entire area and put almost a paralysis, if I can speak today, paralysis on the whole rescue effort, not only for New Orleans, but for the surrounding areas. In fact, the fact is, and authorities testify to the fact, that they had to suspend some of their rescue efforts on individuals because of the fact of the threats and the violence being exercised against those people who were rescuing. So in their own society, sir, blacks should do quite well, if you were right. And in our society, whites will do so well. So, and plus, blacks won't have any white, old, mean old white racists above them to dictate to them. So why don't we work out something with black leaders, and we'll work out something with white leaders, and we'll try to be really fair about this and give them a decent area of the earth, whether it be part of the United States or make an agreement with another country that needs some of the black skills and so forth they've gotten from white civilization and some of the economic input, and let's let black people aspire toward their own society. Louis Farrakhan believes in this. Malcolm X was a big advocate of this. You know, James Meredith was an advocate of the empowerment of our own black communities. And in the meantime, we can help blacks control their own communities, their own schools, and have their own values there and take responsibility there. And not that so they can't blame some white racist for the problems of the crime or the drugs. And again, whites in our own communities we can have the same rights. You know, they can have the same kinds of abilities. That wouldn't harm anyone. In fact, I think it would be very positive for all. But again, this individual, he doesn't, again, he's so concerned about white racism, you know, and he started talking about genetics and all that. Read that article that I was telling you about, I'm working on now. Listen to my show carefully from yesterday. And it talks about the real ultimate supremacism and racism that exists, and that is Jewish supremacism. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hope that all of you will do a lot to spread this program around and to keep this effort going and to really help our people find the way to their freedom and to the preservation of their heritage. I'm going to continue to work as hard as I can and spread the word and continue to educate and motivate our folks. I hope that all of you will do the same. I need you to do the same. I can't do this by myself. And by the way, we're going to try to get a few people together. We're going to try and get a little group together this next weekend to help repair some of our facility here in Mandeville. If you can come in, if you have a sleeping bag, we have a place for you to sleep. Or you can choose to go to a hotel. It's up to you. But if you could work with us for a couple days, that would be very great. And I will be happy to share a meal with you and to convene with you and break bread with you, and we'll talk about the major issues at the same time. You have a chance to get to know me very well, get to meet James Kelso, and meet some of the other activists in the movement, and we'll do a little work and try to get our offices back in shape again. Thanks so much for everything, and I will look forward to seeing you again tomorrow. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
This has been David Duke for our heritage and our freedom.